Welcome to the CSIS podcast. I'm Colm Quinn. On this episode, we're talking about the Zika virus and the outbreak that has left over 1 million people in South America and elsewhere infected. The virus leads to flu-like symptoms in most people, but it's the connection to microcephaly that has raised the alarm and caused the World Health Organization to declare it a public health emergency. Microcephaly is a birth defect causing abnormally small heads in newborn babies. To date, there have been over 4,000 cases in Brazil alone, and so the virus could pose a threat to pregnant women and those looking to conceive. Where it gets worse is that there's still not much known about the Zika virus, making a counteroffensive even more difficult. To talk us through the international response and implications is Steve Morrison, head of our Global Health Policy Center at CSIS.
So the science is very muddy. The science is quite confusing at the moment. The causal link has not been categorically and clearly established, and there's a race underway. In Brazil and other places like Colombia, where there have been cases of microcephaly, to try and get the advance the science, accelerate the science, and most importantly, get some rigor around the definition of what is microcephaly, try to get some coordinated action across the science. And that's what is happening right now. Now, a little over a week ago, the WHO, the World Health Organization, the Director General, Margaret Chan, called together the emergency committee, 12 independent experts called together to weigh the evidence, and they come in with a recommendation to her, which she endorses, to declare a global health emergency.
Can we talk about that? How does that move up the chain? How does it move up the chain from, you know, doctors recognizing this in Brazil to the WHO calling this meeting and getting this emergency response?
Yeah, under the international health regulations, which came into force in 2007, it empowers the director general of WHO to, on the basis of recommendations from an emergency committee, to make a determination of whether this is a public health emergency of international concern, whether it qualifies as something that is an epidemic that is threatening to go global or threatening consequences that extend beyond a localized outbreak. And in this case, the WHO had come under severe criticism for the delays with respect to Ebola. The declaration in 2014 on Ebola was made in early August 2014, many months after the initial cases had been discovered of Ebola, and there was huge controversy and criticism. In this case, the director general was alerted, called this committee into action. There were some criticism for delay. The determination was that this was an outbreak of microcephaly. The emergency was not Zika emergency. There is an emergency because there are these large outbreaks of microcephaly. We don't understand fully the science and the causal factors, and we need to move ahead expeditiously on that. Zika is regarded as one of the most likely causal factors here. Just to emphasize, it's thought now that within the next couple of weeks we should have much better scientific evidence to make a determination on causality. I want to emphasize also, when you look at these cases in Brazil, the suspected 4,100 cases, there's a problem of confirming which are truly microcephaly cases and which are not of infants. And then there's a suspicion that there are many other cofactors that come into play, that you could have conditions of extreme poverty, you could have poison, you could have a contaminated environment, you could have co-infection with dengue or chikungunya, you could have some prior dispositions. You could have drug and alcohol entering into this. It's a big puzzle, and it's one that's now urgently under action.
So in a couple of weeks, we'll figure out there'll be a lot more data, there'll be a lot more ability to describe what the causes are. What about the spread? Now that it's on the American continent, does the U.S. have something to fear?
Well, let's keep in mind, first of all, in terms of Zika virus carried by the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the virus has spread at an explosive rate to now over 28 countries in South America, the Caribbean. We will see cases of transmission this summer on U.S. soil. There are coastal areas in the south where that species of mosquito operates, where there have been pockets of outbreaks of chikungunya and dengue, where you can expect that. The other problem, of course, is importation of cases. Travelers in the United States who travel to areas where there's a Zika virus. And obviously the principal focus here is on pregnant women or women who might soon become pregnant. And how do you protect them? And so the administration, the Obama administration on January 15th, issued a level 2 alert advising pregnant women or women who are considering pregnancy to not travel, to the zones where Zika is endemic. There is one case in Hawaii of a woman who had lived in Brazil, returned to Hawaii pregnant, and gave birth to a child with microcephaly. So we have one case here in the United States of that kind. We're going to see more cases. Because this affects pregnant women, and if it translates into microcephaly, it has grave damage on that infant. These are poignant and compelling cases and highly sensitive ones. So they're ones that are going to raise anxiety. They're ones that are going to feed a media frenzy. They're ones which are going to beg the question of, are we doing everything possible to communicate what the real risks are and what the choices should be. It's also very important to emphasize, it's really hard to control mosquito populations, whether they are mosquito populations in the United States, that as we get into the summer months, the range of movement will expand from along the narrow coastal bands. We also, it's important to acknowledge that in U.S. territories, in Puerto Rico and U.S. Virgin Island, that there are a number of Zika cases there that are reported, and that poses a special problem under U.S. writ in terms of protection and assistance. Another thing I want to emphasize is we don't have a vaccine for this. We do not yet have rapid tests. There's a lot of evidence that we may soon see some rapid tests introduced, which would be a terrific news. There's a big accelerated effort now to bring forward vaccines. The National Institutes of Health have a hybrid vaccine fashioned after vaccines, virus components from dengue and chikungunya, that they are going to rush into trials in August, they've reported, with the hopes that they will get through the first phase of trials by the end of this year and be able to move things forward in 2017. There's about 15 different firms worldwide that are moving ahead at some point with the possibility of developing vaccines.
And the U.S. is also allocating some funds to this, some $1.8 billion. What's that going to go towards?
Well, the White House came forward with a request for a supplemental. If you remember, during Ebola, of course, the immediate response was funded out of existing budgets. And then the president at the end came forward with a $5.4 billion request that Congress approved, well, $6.2 billion, and Congress approved $5.4 billion of that for both domestic capacity building as well as finishing the fight overseas and beginning to build capacity. This is similar. It's $1.8 billion, of which $830 million is going to CDC, predominantly for domestic purposes, for mosquito control, for education, for research, for training. And then there's another $250 million in that request to provide care in Puerto Rico for women who are in need of additional services and care. $380 million to USAID and State Department for overseas programs to assist Brazilians and others in South America and the Caribbean. $200 million to help accelerate the research and development of new vaccines, tests, and therapies, and some money for an emerging threat fund. So we'll see what happens in Congress on this. The deliberations happened this week. There's been very strong expressions of support from the Democratic Party leadership. The hearings and briefings that took place this week were, I thought, very informed and civil. We'll see what happens. I think some form of a supplemental will go through fairly soon, whether it's $1.8 billion or a slightly lesser number. We'll see what happens.
It's really important to have good communication. when there's a virus like this that people don't really know much about, people don't really know necessarily what it does yet. What can government agencies do, and what would you recommend they do to try and educate people and to maybe tamp down the possibility of any hysteria building like happened before with Ebola?
Well, I think the challenge is very similar. This is a confusing situation. The science is murky. It's getting better day by day, but it's still confusing and murky. It's a rapidly evolving situation, and it involves pregnant women and babies as the most vulnerable populations. So the communication strategy of telling the public what do we know and what do we not know, trying to be realistic and humble, trying to be cautionary, trying to avoid a runaway media frenzy, trying to avoid runaway hysteria and panic, preserving trust and confidence in public authorities and science, that is going to be another major challenge. And the fact that this is not, I mean, this is a scary disease. It's a new disease. It's a new disease. It's alien. It's confusing. It's by definition scary. People are going to be frightened. It's not as frightening as Ebola in the way that it operates. It's not lethal in that sense. Nonetheless, it is going to scare people for the reasons that we just talked about. And it's very important that the White House, CDC, NIH are out in front communicating a consistent message. I think that all of them have been very fast out of the box this time around, with a very aggressive and consistently articulated set of messages about the evolving science and what do we know and not know and the guidelines that are being issued. This is a rolling situation. There's a lot of learning happening. We should expect the guidelines will evolve as they did with respect to Ebola. We're going to learn things in the next couple of months that are going to have to be factored in to the response. I think the leadership is going to have many of the same problems it faced in Ebola, which are, first of all, public health responses are ultimately the responsibility of states and localities. And if the authorities at those levels differ in their views or their understanding, or they're not taking on the advice that's coming from the White House or from CDC or from NIH, they can march off in another direction. And so, you know, we do not have a public health system that is hierarchical and top down. We have one that's distributed, fragmented, prone to confusion. Secondly, we have so many media outlets, and so many of them that can feed fear and hysteria and misinformation. And so, you know, the U.S. government sources on this they fight a tough battle. They fight a tough battle in getting the correct messages out and making sure that they're understood by the American people.
Looking ahead, Brazil is now looking in August at hosting the Olympics. We host them in Rio. Do you think we'll know enough then about the virus to be able to provide a proper response there, or to provide proper recommendation to people who will be going, and people, and how Brazil will be affected by perhaps people not going because of the threat of the virus?
That's a great question. A couple of dimensions to this. The Olympics are in August, so we'll know more as we get closer to the Olympics. Interestingly, when WHO issued its emergency declaration, it did not argue that it did not echo the U.S. travel advisory. It did not urge pregnant women or women considering pregnancy or likely to become pregnant to stay away from the infected areas, including the Olympics in August. And that was seen as a reflection both of the scientific uncertainty but also the power of Brazil, that they did not want to be deterring people from coming. Well, WHO has reversed itself and has begun putting, this week announced an advisory of that kind that's consistent with the U.S. position. It's expected that 200,000 Americans will be going to the Olympics. So that's a challenge in terms of protecting Americans and trying to get compliance and understanding around how the most vulnerable, the pregnant women or women who might become pregnant, need to protect themselves by either not going or, if they are going, what steps to take. The U.S. Olympic teams are struggling with this. There was a piece in the Washington Post this morning about how the athletes themselves, and particularly women, are asking hard questions around what are their risks and should they go. And the goalie in the women's soccer team, Hope Solo, took a fairly strong position about, given what we know today, she might very well not go and is pushing. The Olympic Committee, U.S. Olympic Committee, is hiring a couple of infectious disease specialists to advise them. This is going to be repeated over and over, I think, among teams that are seeking to figure this out. I want to mention one other thing, which is the discovery that there is transmission through semen of this virus. So this is another twist, which is, you know, it's thought that, you know, this is transmitted just from a mosquito to a human and an infected mother to the infant through the placenta. But now you have this added dimension, which is there can be sexual transmission, heterosexual transmission, and that also has triggered guidance around how men should be protecting themselves, either refraining for sex or using contraception. That's an important additional thing that we're learning. So the Olympics are going to be a big issue. The Brazilians are very worried. The teams that are that are sending their athletes are worried. Tourists are reconsidering. And we'll see what happens. I don't think you're going to see a sudden clarification of things that eases people's concerns between now and August. I think the concerns will remain at a fairly high level. One other thing that I want to mention here is that this issue has brought forward issues around abortion and contraception. In many Latin countries, there are outright bans on abortion and severe penalties for those who are suspected of terminating pregnancies, Salvador being one case. Some of these countries, like Salvador, have come forward, several of them, come forward and urged women to delay pregnancy for 2 years. That's brought forward questions around, well, why can't women have much broader and open access to contraception, particularly poor women, because poor women are the ones with the least protection and their highest vulnerabilities. And moreover, why couldn't there be a revisitation of policies towards abortion if you have a pregnant woman who has confirmed that she's carrying to term a microcephalic baby? These issues have raced to the fore. They're very complicated on scientific grounds, but they're obviously very complicated on political and ethical grounds, where these issues in our own society but across the Americas continue to be debated out. So you're going to see more and more on that dimension as well. You're going to see more and more of that this week on the Hill when the administration was presenting its $1.8 billion, and there were concerns being raised about, well, is any of this money going to be put towards, in our foreign assistance, put towards promotion or advocacy of abortion and abortion services? And the answer to that is no, absolutely no. There's an outright ban on that in terms of U.S. foreign assistance.
And that was Steve Morrison bringing us to the end of this week's show. We'll be back again next week, so until then, thanks for listening.